there's no such thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Today's guest is acclaimed writer and historian Ian Baruma, joining us to discuss his powerful book, Berlin, 1939 to 1945, a vivid portrait of a city at the center of history's darkest chapter. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Last week we celebrated Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel's birthday, the 78th anniversary of its Independence Day, but it was a bit of a muted holiday, to be honest. First, by the fact that even with ceasefires in place, Israel remains at war with Iran and with the Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon. Second, by the fact that an international campaign of anti-Israel propaganda has been quite effective at slandering the only democratic state in the Middle East, falsely condemning Israel with insane claims of genocide, and denying Israel's very right to exist. And more people believe this contrafactual propaganda than ever have before. Those considerations, serious as they are, should not diminish our appreciation of the miracle of Israel's existence and resilience. It is important to recall that until the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, which came about through a vote of the United Nations, Jews had no guaranteed place of refuge when things went bad in the countries we lived in. That included the possibility of coming to the United States, by the way. Jewish immigration to America was high in the period between the 1880s and the early 1920s, but when trouble began in earnest in Germany and all over Europe in the 1930s, the United States was in an isolationist period and very anti-immigrant. That should sound familiar, no? So just when Hitler was fomenting the worst anti-Semitic pogroms in all history, just when the Nuremberg Laws were going into effect, and eventually, of course, during the genocidal Holocaust of European Jewry, Jews fleeing the Nazis had nowhere to go, not even to America. Had Israel existed in the 1930s, the fascist perpetrators of the Shoah would not have been able to murder 6 million Jews, 2 million of them children. The very existence of a Jewish state that accepts immigrants, if they are even one quarter Jewish without exception, is a gigantic change for our people and for the world. In the years immediately following its founding in 1948, after the Israeli victory in the hard-fought and close-fought War of Independence against many much larger Arab armies, Israel accepted and absorbed more Jewish immigrants than it had citizens initially, by a factor of 2 or 3. That is, the 800,000 or so original Israelis, about 650,000 of whom were Jewish, the rest predominantly Muslim and Christian Arabs, saw refugees fleeing persecution, primarily from Arab countries, flood into Israel. Initially, there were the displaced Jews of Europe, Holocaust survivors. The Allies had herded into camps in places like Cyprus, and even into camps in Germany itself. That's right, some of the emaciated survivors of the Nazi torture camps were put into new camps by the British and the Americans until they could get into Israel, a process that sometimes took several years and a lot of bribes and even illegal activities to accomplish. Jewish immigrants to Israel also came to Israel from Egypt and Morocco and Yemen and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan and Libya and Tunisia and Algeria and Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan, all places Jews had lived in for many, many centuries, even millennia, literally thousands of years. But now our people were forced out and typically robbed of anything they possessed by the governments of these countries as they fled, arriving in Israel with little but their clothes and their Zionist dreams of some 1,800 years. And soon, more refugees still, Jewish refugees, came to Israel, escaping oppression in Hungary and other Iron Curtain countries under the Soviet Union's Iron Rule, before increasing Russian control choked off even that immigration to Israel for decades. And yet, somehow or other, this new Jewish nation, economically and natural resource poor, which had to dedicate a tremendous amount of its limited budget to defending itself and developing infrastructure, still managed to integrate and include all these new arrivals into the nation, seeing them as positive resources and additions to the country. They certainly proved to be that. It was an amazing feat, and today we unfortunately take it for granted. Some insane people call it colonialism. As we said on Pesach, if accepting all of these immigrants from all over the world was all that Israel accomplished by its existence, saving them from persecution and robbery and even death in their home countries, well, Dayenu, it would have been enough. But of course, that is far from all that Israel has accomplished. By the way, if the many Arab countries surrounding Israel had done nearly as much, or frankly anything positive for the 200,000 or so Arab refugees of the War of Independence way back in 1948, they would have long ago been successful in the many Arab nations of the Middle East, absorbed, incorporated, risen to the top. The existence of the Palestinian problem is the direct manufactured result of the conscious choices of many Arab leaders to keep those particular Arab refugees in poverty and misery, primarily so they could be used against the Zionist state of Israel. Tragically, it often resulted in terrible results for the countries that kept those Arab refugees in camps. Jordan and Lebanon were convulsed by civil wars initiated by what were now called Palestinian Arabs. In Lebanon's case, its country and society have never fully recovered. Later, Israel welcomed and absorbed endangered Jewish populations from Ethiopia, from the former Soviet Union, from India, from Ukraine, from Argentina, from anywhere and everywhere Jews felt threatened with persecution. Israel was and is a nation of Jewish refugees from everywhere in the world. And if that was all that the Jewish state accomplished, that would have been enough. But of course, Israel has done much, much more, created amazing modern cities, excavated and displayed fantastic archaeological heritage, pioneered desert agriculture and water use, become an international center of high-tech and medical technological development, of the arts and literature and scientific development. Of course, it also won a series of wars against vicious enemies who desired its destruction. It had to win. Israel did, and so it did. And the Israelis have created a fantastic country filled with art, culture, incredible food, technology, music, development, and of course, history. In Israel, the most ultra-religious Jews coexist within blocks of the largest pride festival for LGBTQ plus people in the Middle East. Okay, it's the only pride festival allowed in the Middle East, but the one in Tel Aviv is also one of the very largest in the whole world. Israel's a diverse, dynamic, exciting, creative, fun, serious nation, worthy of wonderful celebrations every Yom HaAtzmaut and, frankly, any time. No matter the current conditions, which are always variable. I mean, this is by far the most advanced countries in one of the most challenging regions in the planet, the Middle East. May it continue to thrive and flourish, and may peace come finally and completely, allowing it to grow and develop in its own amazing creative ways. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's an Israeli pop hit of recent vintage, Be'er Tasi's Ma Yihyeh Machar. Who knows what'll happen tomorrow? Well, you could say that at any time over Israel's 78-year history, of course, certainly now. But we know it will continue to develop and flourish. Am Yisrael Chai, after all.
לא לפחד, פשוט לקפוץ אל המים ולשמור חבר אחד קרוב. ואיפה שתלכי אקרא לזה בית, אז אני גר כמעט בכל רחוב. לא לנסות סתם להסתיר געגוע, זה יאכל אותנו מבפנים. דקה דקה ואז שבוע שבוע, זה מגיע כשלא מחכים. הייתי לוקח הכל לריאות, אמצע הלילה אני באורות. פשוט רציתי לחבק אותה, כי מי יודע מה יהיה מחר. הייתי הולך גם יחף על קוצים, רוצה אותך בין מיליוני אנשים. פשוט רציתי לחבק אותה, כי מי יודע מה יהיה מחר. ללמוד לעוף כמו ציפור בשמיים ולראות מעבר לתמונה. לרכוב על הדמיון כמו על אופניים, להרגיש כמו פעם ראשונה. אולי בחוץ אני נראה קצת קשוח, זה עובר לאט עם השנים. דקה דקה ואז שבוע שבוע, זה מגיע כשלא מחכים. הייתי לוקח הכל לריאות, אמצע הלילה אני באורות. פשוט רציתי לחבק אותה, כי מי יודע מה יהיה מחר. הייתי הולך גם יחף על קוצים, רוצה אותך בין מיליוני אנשים. פשוט רציתי לחבק אותה.
That was Per Tassi and his song Ma Yihyeh Machar. I'll take all the air into my lungs and hug you now, he sings, because who knows what may happen tomorrow. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be Professor Ian Baruma, author of Stay Alive, Berlin, 1939 to 1945, a fascinating examination of the reality of life in the capital city of Nazi Germany throughout World War II, including the author's father's story. He was a forced laborer for the Third Reich. We'll hear all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish. Ian Baruma is the author of a number of books. Paul Williams, professor of human rights and journalism at Bard College, a former editor of the New York Review of Books. His new book is extraordinary. It's about Berlin. It's called Stay Alive, Berlin 1939 to 1945. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning.
You are from the Netherlands, educated there and in Asia. You've written extensively about Asia. What attracts you to Berlin, particularly in 1939 to 1945?
Well, I suppose one reason is that my father, who was a student during World War II in Holland, which was then occupied by the Nazis, was forced to go and live in Berlin. Work in Berlin in a factory. So I heard stories about Berlin from my father when I grew up. I think the other reason I'm attracted to Berlin is that there's a certain element of nostalgia. And by that I mean a nostalgia for the pre-Nazi Europe. Many cities, not only Berlin, were sort of offered a model of a cosmopolitan, modern, free-spirited civilization, which, of course, had a strong influence elsewhere of Jewish writers and intellectuals and artists and composers. And by either kicking them all out or killing them, Hitler killed, Hitler murdered that culture. And I have a certain nostalgia for that particular culture.
Your mother's Jewish, of course, and you come from such a complex background. It perhaps gave you a unique perspective. You know, I saw a TV show recently, The Defeated, about Berlin in 1945. It's not pretty. Tell us a little bit about what really happened within the city over the course of this time.
Well, one aesthetic model that I had when I thought of ways to write this history of Berlin from the first day of the war until the last was those paintings, and you see them in many countries in different periods of in cities, one painting shows that these great ideal cities full of glitter and gold, and then you see how they are ruined. And of course history is full of great civilizations and great cities that end in ruin. And so in the beginning, my father first got there in 1943, after which there had been quite a lot of bombing. The city was still intact. It was still an 18th and 19th century, 20th century city. By the time he left on an army truck, there was very little left. It was just a pile of rubble.
It's an extraordinary story, and the mindset of the people, I think, is unique. We'll talk much more with Ian Baruma about his new book, Stay Alive, Berlin 1939 to 1945, when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established 7.5 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation, Northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services Friday night at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Onik Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. with services at 10 a.m. All of our services are also broadcast on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests always. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Torah Tikes program for the youngest kids, Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with terrific Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come to services, but you can also go to any of our many classes. We teach everything about Judaism, from Bible to Hebrew to Kabbalah mysticism. You can find out more about us from our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or go to our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. For more about Beit Simcha, to sign up, to join us, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, adult education academy courses, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, all taught at Beit Simcha, call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us. Please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and Spotify. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
A sober and serious question this morning. We're in the period around Yom HaShoah, Holocaust commemoration. You know, there have been other genocides. There are genocides going on in the world right now, in Africa right now, to a degree in China with the Uyghurs. And you don't hear much about it. Somehow it doesn't matter that in Sudan, and literally a million people have been slaughtered in the name of ethnic cleansing, and nobody talks about it. This isn't just it's a human issue. It should matter to everybody.
It should. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be the case. Even with God's chosen people, you know, we always say never again with reference to the Holocaust. But then we turn a blind eye to massacres of the Rohingya in what used to be called Burma and is now Myanmar.
Myanmar, right
or,
now.
As you pointed out, to the Uyghurs in northwestern China, who are being like systematically exterminated. We don't say anything. We don't protest this. Every year in India, there are acts of violence between Hindus and Muslims on the occasion of certain holidays. And they celebrate by shooting each other. This is a moral outrage. And when we say never again, it's meaningless if it only applies to us. And I frequently get upset about this. And the most shining example in my mind is something that will probably offend a lot of your listeners. But AIPAC, the famous political action group that supports Israel, has a huge annual meeting in Washington, which involves not only people from the Hill and people from the White House, but also overseas leaders. And a few years back, they had a meeting where they invited to sit on the dais and be an honored speaker, the president of Serbia, who is the guy who conceived and executed the genocide of Bosnians in the 90s when the Serbs tried to take over Bosnia. And he still covers that up, doesn't talk about it, but it was, at least in the 90s, the biggest genocide in Europe since the Shoah. And not only did I not hear a peep of protest from the Jewish community, but AIPAC, one of the most prominent and well-known organizations in the Jewish community, invites this guy to be their guest of honor.
You know, look, to balance it, not to balance AIPAC's actions, but it does seem as though the slaughter of civilians happening in Nigeria now to Christians, it's certainly happening in a variety of places around the world. It only makes the news in America and Europe if it involves Jews, especially if it involves the accusation, false, of genocide where Jews are involved. Having said that, as Jews, we have to object to these kinds of terrible things happening anywhere in the world they occur. It's a moral obligation. And around Yom HaShoah, we have to remember, yes, our people experienced very likely the worst genocide in human history, but others are experiencing similar things today.
Right. But it seems that we collectively don't really care if they have a different color skin or they're not part of the Judeo-Christian world. We seem to be very selective in this. And I think it goes to a deeper point about human nature as well. I was reading this fascinating story about one of the pioneers of so-called performance art, who was apparently a very well-known woman that I had never heard of. And she did a big thing in the 60s, when performance art was at its very beginning, of surrounding herself with various tools and implements and weapons, including like guns and knives and razor blades, whatever. And she said, like, for the next 3 hours, I'm just going to sit still, and members of the audience can do whatever they want with the tools around me. And at first, it was pretty benign, but as time wore on and people felt like the woman doing the performance art really wasn't going to react, they got more and more violent, and they started cutting her apart with razors.
Oh, my God.
And no one in the audience raised a voice to stop them. So
wow.
That goes to something more fundamental and deep about human nature than just genocide. We are a dangerous species, human beings.
The most dangerous on the planet, I think, beyond question.
Apparently.
Tom, thanks. A sober and painful subject, but one we have to talk about. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke. Reach your humor, your Bubby and Zadie. New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The rabbi and Moshe are both very hungry. They're standing at the oneg table after Shabbat services, eyeing the last two pieces of cake available. One piece is very large, the other piece quite small. Moshe says, "Rabbi, please, you choose first." "No, no," replies the rabbi. "You choose first, Moshe." Moshe says, "Okay, okay." Puts the big piece of cake on his empty plate. The rabbi is surprised. "Why'd you take the big piece?" "It's not very polite, Moshe." "So which piece would you have taken then?" asks Moshe. "I would have taken the small piece," replies the rabbi. "No? What's the problem, Rabbi?" "That's what you got." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bahar B'chukotai, the double sedra at the end of the book of Leviticus. In these final sections of the middle book of the Torah, there are interesting oddities and lessons at the beginning and end of each of these portions. Bahar begins with a statement, "God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai," saying a seemingly unambiguous phrase. And at the end of the opening covenantal section of B'chukotai, the Torah reiterates that God gave all the regulations and laws contained here at Mount Sinai. Then, finally, B'chukotai concludes the whole book of Vayikra Leviticus by telling us these are the commandments God commanded Moses for the Israelites on Mount Sinai. Okay. Well and good. These rules of holiness and personal conduct must have all been commanded in Mount Sinai. Yet, earlier in Leviticus, it makes it clear God has given most of these commandments not at Mount Sinai itself, but in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting, as the Israelites wandered around the wilderness of Sinai, quite far from the mountain itself. In fact, the whole book of Leviticus is apparently given after we left Sinai and began our journey to the Promised Land. Clearly, as Bahar begins, the Israelites can't be at Mount Sinai at all. What gives? The question troubles all the rabbinic commentators who believe the Torah never wastes a phrase or makes a mistake. Their rather brilliant answer teaches a profound truth. You see, in the rabbinic understanding, Mount Sinai is not just a geographical location, not a simple matter of a specific mountain. Wherever we learn and do mitzvot, whenever we complete ethical acts, do tzedakah, observe religious rituals with sanctity and meaning, study Torah, or work to perfect the world, doing tikkun olam, wherever and whenever we strive to make the world a holier, more Jewish place, then we are standing at Mount Sinai. Almost literally, as committed Jews, we take Mount Sinai with us, bringing God's very presence into the world. It's a powerful message. As we conclude reading this book of Leviticus, a text so focused on creating holiness, we learn that we can make our own lives as holy as the revelation at Sinai simply by studying and living Torah each day, every day, wherever we are. Yes, in Israel, but also in Tucson, Arizona, or wherever you live or find yourself. May we each find ways to do so today, here and wherever we go. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Ian Baruma, author of a fascinating new book on Berlin during World War II, will share his own backstory, including his Jewish mother and the complexity of life in the capital of the Third Reich during and at the end of World War II. It's a surprising and unusual story. Hear it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
A concert to raise money for the victims of the shooting attack on a Hanukkah party in Sydney's Bondi Beach has been canceled. Why? Because the Greek choir that was to take part voted not to sing with the Jewish choir. A majority of the members of the 50-member Australian Hellenic Choir politically objected to singing alongside the Sydney Jewish Choral Society. Others said they did not feel safe in a joint performance with Jews. I was not expecting this to happen at all. We've performed with the Jewish choir without issue since 2022, the Greek choir's founder and president, James Tsoulakis, told an Australian newspaper. He added, "The Jewish people are all into it. I'm into it." But the Greek choir was a bit anti-doing it because of the political climate. The concert for Hope and Unity, which had received government support from Australia, was to have featured the Ballad of Mauthausen, about a romance between a Greek and Jewish prisoner at the Nazi concentration camp. The groups performed the piece together back in 2022, but the reaction to the Gaza war has perceptions of Jews across Australia, including, Tsoulakis said, within his community, changing. "There's a bit of anti-Semitism in the Greek community. I didn't realize the extent of it," he said. "Unfortunately, we have a lot of people in the community blaming the Jewish community for what's happening in Israel." "That's not correct," Tsoulakis added. "You want to hate Netanyahu? Hate Netanyahu. But what have the Jewish people done to you? The whole anti-Semitism thing has got to be wound back." Since Hamas's October 7, 2023 war crime atrocity attack on Israel and the resulting war in Gaza, Australian Jews have faced mass anti-Israel protests, exclusion from arts and other communities, and spasms of violence, including arson attacks on synagogues and, of course, the Bondi Beach massacre, which murdered 15 people celebrating Hanukkah on the beach in December. Following the Bondi Beach massacre and under pressure from the Jewish leaders to respond more forcefully, the Australian government finally established a Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, examining policies and practices that have contributed to anti-Jewish sentiment in Australia. The Jewish Choral Society has made an official complaint to the Royal Commission, according to a letter sent by its chair, Anne Spira, telling the 30 members that the concert's cancellation is terrible. Spira told the Australian newspaper that the incident reflected a broad dynamic many Australian Jews have experienced. "The result is, like many other Jews in the arts since 7th October 2023, we have been canceled," Spira said. "We've been deplatformed. It is deeply unsettling for us and for the broader Jewish community, who have been the target of anti-Jewish racism in this country for 2.5 years. Australia's largest Jewish groups did not immediately comment on the cancellation, but the Australian Jewish Association, a center-right advocacy group, tweeted it was disappointing. The Greek City Times, an Australian publication, called the choir's vote embarrassing. The Australian newspaper said in an editorial the incident was an appropriate topic for the Royal Commission. The vote to opt out of the event beggars belief, the editorial said. In light of anti-Semitic tensions that have revered their ugly head in Australia since October 7, 2023, those who didn't want to be associated with a Jewish choir event have displayed an alarming lack of historical empathy and understanding. Indeed. In America, two teenagers were arrested this week for an alleged plot to drive through a Houston synagogue and kill as many Jews as possible. According to local authorities, Angelina Han Hicks, 18 years old, of Lexington, North Carolina, was arrested at home last week and charged with conspiring with two other individuals to commit an attack on Congregation Beth Israel, oldest Jewish house of worship in Texas. According to the Davidson County Sheriff's Office, she's being held in the Davidson County Jail under a $10 million bond. In Houston, a 16-year-old boy was also arrested in relation to a threat directed towards certain Jewish institutions. It was unclear whether the second arrest was connected to Hicks, but the judge who ordered Hicks detained said she had to be prevented from communicating with unnamed co-conspirators. At this time, there is no other known credible threat, the Houston police said. Congregation Beth Israel, a Reform synagogue, and the Schlenker School, a preschool and elementary school that shares its campus, temporarily closed following the threats. District Court Judge Carlton Terry said the alleged conspiracy was to kill as many Jews as possible by driving through a congregation at a synagogue. Hicks is remaining in custody after her arraignment. Allowing a co-conspirator a chance to communicate with either of those individuals or those who could relay a message puts lives at risk, Terry added. The arrest came a month after a guy drove a fireworks-laden truck into Temple Israel in suburban Detroit. The attack, which left the terrorist dead, also followed an arson attack on Beth Israel congregation in Jackson, Mississippi, which destroyed that synagogue's library. In other news, a five-person international jury at the Venice Biennale says it will no longer consider entries from Israel or Russia in its award deliberations, though it didn't name either country in its announcement. The jury announced its decision in an online arts publishing platform. In a statement, the Venice jury explained it would refrain from the consideration of those countries whose leaders are currently charged with crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court. The ICC, located in The Hague, Netherlands, is an intergovernmental body prosecuting international crimes. In 2024, the ICC put out arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and his former or then defense minister on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity, charges that they, of course, deny. The year before, the ICC issued a warrant for President Vladimir Putin on charges related to the unlawful deportation of children from the Ukraine. By excluding countries whose leaders have warrants out for their arrest, the judges ruled out Israel, which has faced widespread exclusion in the arts world, and it did so without explicitly doing so. The Venice Biennale opens days after the Eurovision Song Contest, another international arts competition staged in Europe, but one that has refused to bar Israel. Nonetheless, multiple countries have sworn off participation in Eurovision because the European Broadcasting Union rejected calls to ban Israel. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Ian Baruma is a distinguished intellectual. I don't know, can I call you a man of letters? It seems like the right title.
You can call me anything you want.
His new book is called Stay Alive, Berlin, 1939 to 1945. He's the author of many books, including A Tokyo Romance, The Churchill Complex, The Wages of Guilt, Year Zero, A History of 1945. At one point, he edited the New York Review of Books, been a professor at Bard College for many years, and while he has focused on culture in Japan and China, he's also written extensively about Europe. including contemporary European affairs. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and I could go on and on. I want to come back to the book. Our perception, I think, for many of us of Berlin is the center of the Third Reich and Nazism. But Berliners were not really necessarily all bought into that, were they? It's a complicated culture.
No, I mean, in many ways, and we see that in our own time, right-wing populist movements, I mean, radical right-wing populist movements, tend to be a bit like rebellions of the country against the city of ancient Rome. I mean, the idea of the city as a place of sin and wickedness and mixed populations and so on and so forth. And
right.
Berlin was, of course, was a very cosmopolitan, metropolitan city, and it was everything that the Nazis in many ways hated. Many Berliners didn't like it either. So Hitler was always very suspicious of Berlin and Berliners. And so the capital of the Nazi movement was Munich, which felt less, perhaps, cosmopolitan than Berlin did.
Yeah, the beer halls and so on where the putsch began initially. Tell us about the title and Stay Alive.
Well, by the time that the bombing got really bad, around sort of late 1943, when the city was being steadily demolished, first by the British with the RAF, and then later by the U.S. Air Force. The British bombed at night. The Americans, I think, had better radar. Bombed by day, and so the city was bombarded. And instead of saying "Auf Wiedersehen," see you again, goodbye, people said, stay alive, like Dubai. Use that as the title for the book.
The complexity of Berlin as a place, you know, you talk about your nostalgia for it. Can you tell us a little bit about what Berlin was like under the Weimar Republic?
Well, I think people tend to idealize Berlin or the Weimar Republic because it was so vibrant, and the wonderful music being composed by Schoenberg and others, great theater, great movies, the cabarets and the dance halls, and the movie and the musical cabaret, of course, accentuated that. And so people idealize it as a place of constant fun. Anything but. It was also a period in Germany of very fragile democratic politics, huge amount of unemployment.
Right.
The Wall Street crash was devastating. There was an enormous amount of poverty in the city, and hence, you know, crime and prostitution. So it wasn't, in every respect, a happy place, but it was a place of enormous intellectual freedom and artistic experimentation and sexual freedom and all that, which, of course, was snuffed out by the Nazis. And because it was snuffed out so quickly, sort of rather romantic notion of Weimar Berlin as being a sort of an artistic and social paradise, which it wasn't.
From the time of Kristallnacht, obviously something was going to be radically different. How did Berliners adapt?
Well, I think things began different already from 1933 and 1944 when the Nazis took power. And the Jewish population, which was never as large as people often think. I mean, people think Jewish Berlin or Jewish Vienna or Jews in Germany. It was always a fairly small percentage of the population. The educated Jews were very prominent in certain areas, in the arts, banking, and so on. But the noose was tightened from the very beginning, and it got gradually worse. But it was easy for people, as it always is. I mean, there's nothing unique in the 1930s. It's easy for people to look away if problems don't concern them. So you can say, well, it isn't me. It's not my children. It's those people that maybe they did something to deserve it. You didn't have to see it if you didn't want to. So people can live with things happening to other people as long as they can feel that it doesn't concern them. And I think there was a lot of that in Berlin too. Now, there were also people who felt very concerned. Even during the war, after the introduction of the Yellow Star, there were Berliners who would doff their, try and give their places on the tram to somebody wearing a Yellow Star, felt ashamed of what was being done. But many, many more looked away, pretending not to see it.
There's a term that's sometimes applied to Berlin, but really to Germany, called kind of moral insanity or moral amnesia. How accurate is that?
You mean during the Nazi period?
Yeah, during the Nazi period, and then suddenly just after the amnesia kicked in.
Yes. Well, during the Nazi period, I think it was more people were, most people conformed, and not necessarily in an active, opportunistic way to get power and money. Of course, there were such people too, but people tried to basically keep their heads down. After the war, there was probably a lot of hidden guilt. People preferred not to talk about it and rather than instead justify it or say, well, Hitler did good things too, or when there were war crime trials put on by the Allies, it was seen as Allied prejudice and so on and so forth. This began to change really with the second generation, with the children who lived during the war and the Nazi period, who then started asking questions. What did you do? They asked their parents, or what really happened? And they began to rebel against those early years of painful silence.
Talk a little bit about the diary of Eric Kästner and how that affected you in creating this book.
Well, Erich Kästner was an interesting figure because he was not a Nazi. He was anti-Nazi and wrote an anti-Nazi novel in the 20s, which was burned along with his other books in the famous book burning under the Nazis in the 30s. He was, as they would have said at the time, an undesirable and unreliable person. But unlike some others who were anti-Nazi, he decided he was not going to leave Germany. This is a phenomenon you find in all dictatorships, this question of those who have the chance to leave, should you leave? Those who leave often resent the people who stayed, and those who stayed resent the people who left. But Kästner decided to stay, and he said, not because he admired the regime, on the contrary, but his feeling was, I'm a German writer, this is my language, this is my country, and it's my duty to chronicle the dark side, the dark pages of our history just as much as the good side. And he was very, very close to his mother, who lived in Dresden, who didn't want to leave. So for those who say in Russia today, who say people who stay in Russia now are all complicit and so on, for those who take that judgment, I think Erich Kästner is an interesting example of why one shouldn't be so quick to judge people. There are perfectly good reasons for honest and decent people to stay even under terrible.
You know, one of the things that comes out is for a lot of the Berliners, things were semi-normal until the bombings really started.
On the surface, they were semi-normal. Of course, nothing was normal under the Nazis. It was a dictatorship. Jews were being actively persecuted. I mean, it was not a normal society, but whatever one means by normal. But on the surface, everything was done to make it easy for the non-Jewish population to feel that life was still going on as though it were normal. So the cinemas were full. Cafes were full. People went to the theater. The musical life went on. The kids went to school. The football the soccer competition continued until the end of the war. So you could pretend that things were normal, even though under the surface, of course, it was anything but.
You have a really interesting incident about a Jewish guitarist or a half-Jewish guitarist named Coco Schumann. Who was playing jazz in 1943, which was verboten under the Nazis. Can you tell that story a little bit?
Well, jazz, like other of American popular culture, were very popular in Germany, and particularly in Berlin. And they played Hollywood movies until the end of 1941, when Hitler declared war on America. So, and jazz in particular was very popular. And you had the so-called the swing youth. And Coco Schumann was part of that. And they were rebellious, not that they were in the resistance necessarily, but they were rebellious just by listening to American jazz records and secrets and that kind of thing. And as Coco Schumann once said, when you swing, you don't march.
I think what's the incident where they greet each other by saying, swing Heil?
That sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah.
But he was half Jewish, but according to the Nazi racial rules, he counted as fully Jewish because he was educated, he was raised as a Jew. You were not raised as a Jew. You were in a slightly, you were in a different category from Corporal Schumann, who was counted as a Jew.
The reality of the war comes to Berlin when the bombing starts. It starts fairly early with British bombers, but it really becomes intense from, I don't know, 1943 or so. But the deportation of the Jews is before that. And yet some Jews survive inside Berlin in the heart of this Reich, this Nazi Reich, throughout the war. How did they do it?
Well, it was very, very difficult and extremely dangerous. They went, as it were, under the water. And it helped to be young and healthy because it was extremely tough. You had to change places the way you slept all the time. Some people survived sleeping part of the time in sleeping in the ruins. It also helped to be attractive and pretty because you relied entirely on strangers. And strangers would often only help you temporarily if there was a quid pro quo. There were decent Germans who did risk their lives and the lives of their families to hide Jews. Not all that many, but they were there. There's one character in my book who survived for a while by staying in a brothel. And so there were decent people. There were other people who helped because they wanted something in return. But it was a very, very precarious existence, and only several thousand survived.
Your dad came to the capital, what was it, 1943? Tell us just a little bit about his experience.
Well, first of all, how he got there. Because the Germans were running out of manpower in their factories, because all the young men were fighting on the battlefronts, they desperately needed labor. And having labor from concentration camps and so on was not enough to fill that. And so they decided that young men in occupied countries had to come and work in Germany. And my father was a law student, and they gave students the opportunity to postpone this if they would sign a loyalty oath to the Nazi occupation authorities. And my father refused and went into hiding, and something went wrong. He was called back to his hometown and was told by the Nazi police that if he didn't sign up, his parents could be arrested. And he didn't dare take that risk, so he signed and via a concentration camp. He ended up in Berlin in his factory.
The book is called Stay Alive, Berlin, 1939 to 1945. I want to thank Ian Baruma for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people find out more about the book and more about you?
Well, it's in most bookstores. I saw piles in Barnes & Noble. It's on Amazon, so it's easy to get.
I recommend you get it. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Elizabeth Poliner, award-winning author of the new book, Spinning at the Edges. And please join us at Beit Simcha every Friday night. Services noting Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org, for our services and class schedules, and to sign up for our new Torah Tykes membership for the littlest kids. As we move through the period of the counting of the Omer, the last weeks between Passover and Shavuot on the Jewish calendar, our playout this morning comes from the introduction to the daily ritual of Sfirat HaOmer, the counting of the Omer, from the London Jewish Male Choir. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Mezuman lekaye mitzvat ase shel sefirat haomer kemo shekatuv batorah
kemo shekatuv batorah Shvatem lachem mimocharat ha-shabbat Miyom aviyachem et omer hatnufa
Shvatem lachem mimocharat ha-shabbat Miyom aviyachem et omer hatnufa
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.